It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, once again, it's time for another edition of Valley Edition, and it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Terry Snyder and friend.
My comfort dog,
right.
Bella.
Yes, we need that sometimes. And on the phone, on the road, none other than Zaz Hollander, returned from a trip to the East Coast. Welcome,
that's right.
Zaz. Yes,
Terry. Thanks, Mike. It's good to be back. I do not have my comfort dog with me, however.
Okay. We'll go on. Just having to share you virtually, Zaz, and we in person, Bella's presence. I think I'd like to begin with a startling, in my sense, change to the EMS services being provided in the borough. Terry was there at the meeting on Tuesday. You wrote about it. For listeners who might have missed what's about to happen with the addition of significant personnel and equipment to EMS, how about sharing a little bit of that, Zaz?
Yeah, so this is just this past week, the Assembly approved 25 new responder positions on the emergency medical side. You know, the borough has kind of two different forces. They've got the fire and rescue side and the medic side. And so this is a big change to the way Mat-Su has responded to emergency medical calls. You know, for years, the borough has relied on what are called paid on-call responders. They're not volunteers, but they're not full-time employees with benefits either. They're this kind of gray area. They aren't even considered employees, where they get paid for the hours they work. They can only work up to 29.9 hours. And so these are the people who get up in the middle of the night to respond to ambulance calls. Mm. And so what the borough did this week with this change is put 25 people, some of them supervisors, into ambulances, basically on a scheduled basis. So instead of kind of getting whoever you can get it to in the morning, you've got a crew already staffed up and ready to go. They added two new ambulances as well. So right now there are four fully staffed ambulances in the borough in the core area, one in Palmer, two Wasilla, two Meadow Lakes. One Meadow Lakes. And so now there will be two more. One will be kind of a floating ambulance going where the calls are. And one will be up in the north end of the Susitna Valley at the Y, so at the Talkeetna Spur Road. What the borough is saying is this is really going to help with kind of reliable response to ambulance calls. The borough has 18 ambulances total, but again, only four of those were staffed all the time. This, in theory anyway, adding that many new people, I think it's 17 actual, EMT2s, four paramedics, and then some battalion chief supervisors, should help make sure that there are people who can get into the ambulances and come help you when something bad is happening and you need medical assistance right away. There is some concern, especially among long-time responders that are already struggling in outlying areas, so not the core area, to keep their numbers up. You know, there are fewer people willing to be paid on-call responders, because you can't make a living doing it, and so you have another job that you're juggling. So they're saying this could be it. You know, this could really strike a blow at efforts to recruit more paid on-call responders who are still going to be needed under this new system. So it kind of remains to be seen how that's going to play out.
Terry.
Yeah, a good explanation of it. Far better than I could have done, Zaz. But what I wondered about it is it sounded like they were definitely going to try to promote within. With people that were there, at least with
right.
the people that were on call. And so on the appearance, I would think, well, maybe you would hope that people would see that if they would volunteer in their communities, that could be a road to employment at some point. And I don't know how that sizes up to, I think, doesn't it Eagle River that still has a volunteer force there?
And yep.
How many of those have actually ended up going to work, for the fire department in Anchorage, or
Anchorage.
I don't know. There's
yeah.
a lot to be played out here for sure.
Yeah.
So let's take just a quick look, though, at what was happening at the borough itself, because at that assembly meeting, there was, as I understood, a very pervasive presentation made by the acting EMS director, Ken Barkley, about the need itself. And then secondly, I'm curious, when all was said and done and they went to vote, it was pretty much unanimous, but not quite. Was that true, Terry?
Yeah, I think if I remember it right, George McKee voted against it. And I don't know that this was the meeting that Mr. Barkley gave the presentation. That was a meeting ago, but he certainly answered a lot of questions and deflected a lot of concerns, I would say.
Okay.
But I think that was...
he made reference to just running out of ambulances the night before, which, you know, if you listen to the emergency traffic in the borough, it happens all the time. They're constantly moving ambulances around to staff, you know, with an ambulance gone to Sutton, let's say.
Right.
There's a hole in the core area that needs to be filled by the ambulance moving down from Meadow Lakes. So they're constantly shuffling ambulances around. And I think what Acting Director Barkley said was, I think they had all four of the staff ambulances, but then they also happened to have staffing for a fifth. All of them were out on calls between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m., you know, the morning of Tuesday's meeting. We're recording on Friday. And then I think there was a bad wreck involving a dump truck like an hour or two before the meeting had started, and there were, you know, ambulances, you know, maxed out just responding to that. So it's very easy to use up all the staff ambulances, I think, is the point he was making.
Right, and there was some concern, I think maybe, I can't remember what assembly member this came from, about if this would increase response time. And Mr. Barkley, I think, answered that pretty satisfying in saying that he was pretty confident that not only the overtime, you know, excessive overtime that they've had, but also the response time, you know, was going to be better just simply because the way you've described it so well, Zaz, is that people don't get the call, have to get in their clothes and drive in. You've actually got somebody, at least in a few ambulances, that are already there. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think the big change, I think that question about longer call times, and maybe I'm wrong, but I know Mayor Halter had asked something because he's based in Willow.
Mm.
And so I don't know if it was exactly that question, but that, yes, having a staff ambulance in the Susitna Valley. Because you'll hear calls sometimes where a Willow ambulance is paged out and there's very few drivers available, and they'll end up paging somebody from West Lakes or from the Meadow Lakes area because there's nobody responding from Willow. So having a staff ambulance up in the northern Susitna Valley, at least that's what Ken Barkley was saying, will make a difference up there.
And I might add that back in the day, I spent a little bit of time on ambulance services and in the process visited an urban area, Washington, D.C. And even at that time, and I think what we're talking about here is a classic development that as populations grow in the surrounding rural areas, the central city area, which may be staffed full-time, gradually expands, but that it probably will never reach a point where you don't have both volunteers and paid staff full-time. And it's just finding a way to balance that, to make that happen, because obviously at the fringes, at the points where you move to the area where you have volunteers, you have to work that out. And I think I heard people saying that basically that would be the real trick here, to try to place those ambulances, pay attention to what's happening, and adjust as necessary.
Yeah, and I think in these sort of painful discussions sometimes, it seems like the public, if they're paying attention, learns a lot of things. I know, you know, I followed the EMS thing pretty closely, I thought, but boy, I learned some things about how they don't really have a downtime anymore because the tourist season puts a lot of demands on them. And you know, that when Princess is hauling in people, and demographically a lot of older people, they're called a lot out when they usually, so they just don't have that downtime to kind of recover anymore. It's, their calls are, you know, well documented, are very, very much up. So it's just kind of, you know, all part of that growing part of the borough where we want to be sort of denial about planning, denial about services. People keep coming here is a desirable place to live, and you know, the day of reckoning for some things are part of that.
Well, I'd like to segue to another topic, one which you're very familiar with, Zaz, and this is the extending of the Grunewald case with a first sentencing that was about to hear, or second sentencing, that was complicated, and I read your article. You write well, but I think for listeners and for myself, what happened that there was a delay in sentencing?
Well, a couple of things happened, and this is the sentencing for Eric Allmendinger, who was the first of four teenagers charged in David Grunewald's murder, the first one to be convicted, and so the first one to face sentencing. His hearing had already been put off because it was scheduled for, I think it was last October, maybe November, and the second teenager who was accused, Dominic Johnson, was undergoing trial at that time, so they wanted to wait. And so, you know, finally we get to Eric Allmendinger's sentencing, you know, for a murder that happened in November 2016. And it's again delayed, this time because of a number of late filings in the case and a recent appeals court decision. And so the appeals court decision was, again, involving Stacey Graham, who was the drunk driver who was convicted of murdering two girls on a sidewalk in Anchorage. And the appeals court found, basically tossed his sentence, which was a 32-year sentence, unprecedented for the type of crime and his record, and said that the judge had relied, in among other things, on too much emotional testimony during that particular sentencing hearing. You know, he allowed various police officers, a police chief to speak. He allowed the family to show this kind of heartbreaking video of the girls with, you know, their favorite songs playing behind it. And there were other legal underpinnings to this appeals court decision, but the emotional level that the judge allowed was one of them. And so judges now, that case will probably be appealed, until it is, and in the meantime, it's setting a precedent where judges are being very careful during sentencing just to kind of adhere to what and only what is allowed. You know, family members speaking, making victim statements is fine, but no more than that. And so, you know, Judge Heath, in this case, in the Grunewald case, said that he's received 60 letters from the community expressing, you know, outrage about this crime. And what does he do with those? He needs to figure all those things out. But I think part of the point in this delay is that the defense, Allmendinger's attorney, on Wednesday presented an expert, an adolescent psychology expert about Eric Allmendinger's brain development, and the prosecution, in kind of examining that, said, well, wait a minute, you know, we don't even have an individualized psychiatric assessment of this teenager. And so now you're putting an expert on the stand who's giving a sort of general overview of adolescent brain development. We don't know about this particular kid's brain. And after the prosecution raised that, the defense filed a pretty late motion, I think, just this Monday, in response, saying, no, he doesn't need one of these individualized psychiatric assessments. He's not mentally ill. And the judge said he wasn't happy with that. He didn't feel comfortable with that. You know, any judge in this situation is weighing the future appeal. And so he wants to be careful, he said, and is giving the defense 3 weeks to make a decision on an individualized psychiatric assessment. So any sentencing is at least 3 weeks off, probably more at this point.
And who did they hire? They must hire an expert to come in from outside, because we're certainly having our problems at the API right now.
Well, that came up. That actually came up as a potential issue with finding an expert, if there aren't many of those here.
Mm-hmm. So let's take another step to further along on the role of judges, because obviously, it seems to me that in the past, judges did what they do. They handled case trials and the rest, and we know that there were replacements done, and the process was somewhat below the radar, occasionally popping up. But in the last election, there was a judge that had followed the law, apparently, and had been well-regarded, it seemed, by his peers and others, who was not retained because of a very emotional case that didn't seem to be tied necessarily to his judgment, but to the way the law was constructed. We have recently heard that the governor has decided to not appoint a local Palmer judge out of the set that have been recommended. There's a process that involves a committee that meets that has representation, including the Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court. And there seems to be some maneuvering around some very real question of whether the governor cannot appoint from the list that's provided, et cetera. And now we have your case that you're talking about, which puts the judge in a very interesting position, because the idea of emotion or of these apparently important factors outside of facts that are presented at trial are impinging upon decisions. I'm thinking that the role of the judiciary is going to be more in focus than it has in the past. Terry, any comment?
Yeah, I'm just curious. I'm going to ask a question to Zaz. Is that, do you know which two judges are retiring? Is it the judge in these cases?
Yeah, I know he is. And I can't remember who the other one is, but it's Palmer Superior Court is busy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's they are definitely not in a position to go without any judge on the Superior Court level.
So if Heath retires and you have this prolonged sentencing for this defendant, does he stick around long enough to hear that appeal, or does a new judge hear it, or?
Yeah, I don't know how that works.
And one of the cases have been moved to Anchorage, is that right?
Or
moved
Fairbanks.
Right.
Yeah,
how many,
the last two defendants.
Last two are going to Fairbanks.
Yep, Barry and Renfro.
Okay, so. Yes, all of that. Well, I'd like to then switch to the upcoming visits. This show is being recorded on Friday. Saturday, some members of the House Finance Committee will be out and about listening to people. And I'm not quite sure whether they're going to provide information so much as take testimony. My impression was they were taking testimony because they were still building their case for a particular proposal. On the other hand, next week, what was going to happen is the governor will arrive, and it's a counterpoint in a very different way. My impression is, from what has been revealed, that the governor and his team will be providing information to people. There will be opportunities to ask questions, et cetera, but it's, in colloquialism, a dog and pony show to present what is the present state of the governor's positions. And the controversy, if any, that's around that has to do with how these are structured and who is paying to have this happen, and whether... if it's billed as a appearance by the governor to in a public appearance, how there can be restrictions that make it seem like this is a private event. Terry, you're registered to go to one of these.
Yeah. Well, on a personally speaking, of course, as I always do here, I'm just disappointed both of these events aren't at a high school or somewhere that, based on what I've seen of just the last town halls that have been happening, you know, there are 200, 250 people in both of these venues, the LIO, the public venue that the House is taking is pretty small venue on Railroad. But I will say that they've made it a four-hour event now on a Saturday afternoon, which probably will give a lot more ability for people to actually testify. And that's what I'm told, is that it's a sort of their listening tour. Because they haven't even had the closeout reports from the subcommittees yet. So they themselves have been taking testimony, and plus they have to have all their subcommittees reports. So this is part of them getting out to the public. And I think people should recognize the fact that we have a couple of members on House Finance, I think only one of them is coming, Representative Tilton, although I'm not sure about that. the rest of them aren't from our district, and they may not hear our voices. So there's some controversy whether or not it's well-spent money or not, but it seems like it's being done in a thoughtful manner, and it gives them a chance. People complain a lot, and we hear it a lot here, that the capital's too far away. It's a way to bring a little bit of the capital here. On the other hand, the governor's tour, and it's not unlike what the Walker administration did in that they did go on a tour to out to the public to show them what their plan was that has been presented for consideration to the legislature. But Walker always used high schools and public and Menard Center and public places, and it was never sponsored by a partisan group that this one is. And I think there is some probably well-placed criticisms of that process as more of a gathering of supporters as opposed to actually hearing from critics. And that's a problem for me just personally, because I think you do need to hear from both sides. So it makes it, distinguishes it in my mind as something completely different from what House Finance is doing to what the governor is doing. But I guess we'll just have to see how both of them play out. And as painful as it may be, I'll try to bear witness, no promises. But I think it's an interesting approach to some very difficult priority problems and fiscal matters, I guess I would say.
Okay. Well, anyone who has been watching Gavel to Gavel knows that there's high drama coming. I'm not sure it's been there.
Oh, there's been lots of drama. No lack of drama.
Okay. We have noted, and we probably should mention that at one of the subcommittee meetings, there was a little kerfuffle where three members of the House minority complained. Representative Delana Johnson was preeminent among them. She spoke to it. There apparently had been a presentation of materials to be considered at a Monday meeting. It was presented at 3 p.m. to her office, she said, on Friday. She didn't quite understand why the process had been changed a bit. Apparently, 2 years ago, there had been a process. The last sessions had seen a variation on the process of how you voted on and passed the proposals forward. And this had been a return, actually, as I understand, to the process that had been used 2 years before when the Republicans were in the majority. There was some discussion about it. It was fascinating to watch Gavel to Gavel because there was the complaint. And then the audio went off. Video was still there, so you could watch the discussion going on for about 10 minutes, after which audio came back and the three members of the minority on that particular education committee had left. And it seemed to also be the case in some of the other meetings that I saw that there wasn't as much of a regular attendance by minority members on those committees. And as a result, I think it's safe to say that many of the proposals the governor has made have not made it through the subcommittees. And you can see where this is all headed, probably to a version of what Governor Walker had presented or last year's budget. In the meantime, I think it's important to say that at Wednesday's meeting, the Mat-Su Borough School Board did approve a resolution sending a budget, essentially, with numbers to the borough, with the caveat that they were still watching. They were spending a lot of time watching to see what the final numbers were going to be from the state so that they could actually have a finished budget. And we're left once again saying, this seems to be backwards. If you're dependent upon the state probably needs to complete its work before the borough and before the school board. And yes.
Sure. I think one last thought I had this morning is that we are in a recession. I would say there was some speculation we were coming out of it, but different parts of the state have been impacted differently by that recession. And I think that these travels around the state to hear from people are going to be remarkably different depending upon how your state, number one, has fared through this recession time and what the projected changes that the proposed budget would have on their communities. So I think it's going to be fascinating anyway when it's over, and we'll all need a compassion dog to get us through and beyond, is my guess.
Well, we have just passed through one of those special times when there was a worm moon. And the spring equinox, and we have obviously temperatures into the 40s. I've been waiting to ask Zaz, are the flowers up in Willow yet?
Not in Willow. I do have some iris leaves in the Palmer Fishhook garden.
Ah, okay.
The snow's melting, though.
We're almost there.
Yes.
By next week, we'll be talking about, how much it takes to cut our lawn, right?
Oh, it's not over till it's over, Mike.
I want to thank Zaz Hollander for taking the time to call in and share her observations about some events that have happened this past week. Thank you, Zaz.
Good to be here, Mike. Thank you.
And I want to thank Terry Snyder for coming in and bringing Bella once again so that we could get through another edition of Valley Edition. And we'll be back next week. Have a good day.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.